Good evening. Welcome to this year's Shimizu Lecture. I'm very grateful to the trustees of the Shimizu Fund for supporting this event. The topic of our lecture is the South African Bill of Rights. This document is the latest and perhaps most remarkable installment in the history of Bills of Rights. The success of this movement for Bills of Rights never ceases to astonish me. The combination of a lack of faith in democratic institutions and the consequent placing of trust in a group of judges trained in the law and usually little else to determine the content of a society's institutions and basic ideas of right is surely an unexpected outcome of political emancipation and enlightenment. There is, however, no shortage of advocates for bills of rights. In the Anglo-American tradition of liberal political theory, we have Ronald Dworkin, who sees the moral integrity of society founded on the defense of those rights. From the tradition of German social theory, we have, for example, Habermas, who sees in constitutional courts the closest possible approximation to the ideal speech situation where rational discourse determines political outcomes. Yet we shouldn't forget that at its inception, the idea of a Bill of Rights was patently a bourgeois attempt to fix for all time the basic institutions of society and the distribution of wealth and power. Nevertheless, the Bill of Rights idea appeals simultaneously and paradoxically to the marginalized, the excluded, the downtrodden, through its radical promises of dignity and equality. Perhaps in the history of the South African Bill of Rights, we discover a strange coalition between those who see in a Bill of Rights a way of guaranteeing privilege and those who see in the rights the promise of equality. Or perhaps Derrida is right to see in the Bill of Rights discourse the only remaining meta-narrative capable of justifying anything, any kind of political order. Although in the United Kingdom we've so far resisted joining this movement, other parts of the world where we've enjoyed political influence in the past, such as Canada, Hong Kong, South Africa, the adoption of a Bill of Rights has been perceived as the essential ingredient for political stability. These developments, to my mind, stretch the Bill of Rights as a technique of governance to its limits. In Canada, the Charter is supposed to place a brake on the centrifugal forces which are tearing apart the Federation. In Hong Kong, the Basic Law is supposed to tame the might of the Chinese executive and military power. And now, as we're here this evening in South Africa, the Bill of Rights is supposed to integrate a society which is divided by colour, language, culture, and wealth. So in short, the bourgeois class settlement becomes transformed into an instrument of nationhood and cultural construction. This is surely a transformation which takes the Bill of Rights discourse boldly in directions it's never gone before. Our lecture this evening examines the South African experience. Our lecturer, Professor Alfred Cockerill, in an earlier essay published in the South African Journal on Human Rights, has already written a report on the performance of the South African Constitutional Court in its first term. I'm afraid his report, said in summary, could do better. Indeed, the report was worse. I paraphrase, it resembled some of the comments which I write at the end of undergraduate essays, which, when stated more boldly, say, this is a load of waffle which doesn't really tackle the issues. Needless to say, I never had reason to write such acerbic comments at the end of Professor Cockerill's essays when I taught him as an undergraduate not so long ago. Since then, he's had a meteoric academic career in South Africa, first of all at Cape Town University, and then most recently his appointment as a professor at Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg. He's published promiscuously in both public and private law, and this evening I look forward with great interest to his lecture entitled The South African Bill of Rights and the Duck Rabbit. Thank you, Alfie.
Thank you very much, Professor Coddins, for those kind words, at least mostly kind words as far as I could make out. It's a great pleasure to be here today, and certainly to be visiting London, a city which I haven't visited in a number of years and which has a number of wonderful memories for me. I'd like to thank Professor Coddins for organizing the trip and for making it possible for me to be here tonight. What I'd like to talk to you about tonight is the South African experiment with the Bill of Rights. And I should say right at the outset, within the past 3 years, we've seen a fairly remarkable development in South Africa, really a kind of constitutional coup d'etat, if you like, in terms of which a bright, burnished new doctrine of constitutional supremacy has come to replace what was a tarnished notion of parliamentary sovereignty. This has been a remarkable development in many ways, and what I hope to do tonight is to tease out some of the implications of that, in particular the implications which should be of interest for a foreign audience. I accept, of course, that lots of the details of what South Africa has done with the Bill of Rights will really be of parochial interest only for South Africans, but it does seem to me that the broader issues should be of sufficient significance for anybody interested in the law and in notions of constitutionalism. I want to do quite a lot in the lecture, and in particular I want to focus on three themes. I want to start out by explaining in pretty much a potted history fashion, I'm afraid, exactly what has happened in South Africa in the past 3 to 4 years, outlining how it came about that we now have a Bill of Rights for the first time in our new democratic dispensation. And this will be perhaps somewhat pedestrian in parts, but I'm doing it because I assume, almost certainly correctly, that most people here will not be familiar with anything more than a journalistic knowledge about what has happened in South Africa. The second topic which I want to address tonight is really building on the history. I'd like to tease out two puzzles, at least they strike me as being puzzles, two puzzles about South Africa's transition to a Bill of Rights era. And the third thing which I'd like to do is to look back at what the Constitutional Court has done and to assess what issues about interpretation, legal interpretation, are raised as a result of our transition to a constitutional era in South Africa. So while the first topic tonight will be pretty much a potted history, I think the other two raise some deep and ultimately significant issues for all those interested in law and legality. Let me start then with a brief history of how it came about that we now have a Bill of Rights for the first time in our constitution in South Africa. Although the stink of apartheid will still be fresh, I think, in the nostrils of many South Africans, it's appropriate, I think, to turn back and to face the stench and just to remind ourselves very briefly about what law and legality entailed during the apartheid years. To put the point briefly, for most of this century, the South African legal system functioned in such a way as to entrench the privileges of white inhabitants while depriving black South Africans of even the most basic of human rights. Apartheid was nothing more than a program of institutionalized racism which exploited the machinery of the law in such a way that different races would develop both separately and unequally. Now, I'm not going to go through the detailed legislation which supported apartheid. Most people will be familiar with the essential elements. On birth, every person was allotted a particular racial group. Mixing between the group was prohibited by laws. Economic resources were deliberately skewed so as to ensure that wealth would largely track the racial group of the person concerned. The point I do want to make is that if we look at it in broad terms, it's hard to resist the inference that during the National Party government, the law functioned as nothing more than an instrument of power and repression in South Africa. I think it may be useful here to draw on a typology of legal forms developed by Nonne and Selznick, which is a fairly well-known one. And using that language, the conclusion which we can reach quite comfortably, I think, is that during the apartheid years, the South African legal system was essentially an era of repressive law. What I mean by that is that during apartheid, we witnessed the subordination of law to the requirements of government. We witnessed the integration of law and politics. To put the point more crisply still, during apartheid, the law really functioned as nothing more than a pretty crude instrument for the maintenance of white hegemony. Now, against that background, I think a crucial question which confronted the architects of the new South Africa in the early 1990s was simply this: how does one set about restoring legitimacy to a legal system which had been deprived of credibility in the eyes of the majority of South Africans? It seems to me that that question might easily be conflated with a related question: how does one set about injecting a discourse of rights into a political agenda that had become contaminated and distorted by a discourse of power? That second question flirts with a number of ambiguities, but it's that second question which had been addressed for a number of decades in South Africa in liberal circles. A number of prominent liberal lawyers since at least the 1950s had been calling for the introduction of a Bill of Rights into South Africa's new constitutional dispensation. I don't want to trace in detail the voices which made this call. Suffice it to say that they included Supreme Court judges, a number of university professors in inaugural lectures. In the early 1980s, two chairs of human rights were set up in South Africa, and a journal of human rights was established. Despite these liberal calls for a Bill of Rights in South Africa, largely, of course, as a means of restoring legitimacy to the system, it seems to me that in the 1970s and the 1980s, these liberal voices encountered resistance from two quarters, two powerful blocs which reached a similar conclusion that there should be no Bill of Rights in any future constitutional dispensation. Now, although they reached similar conclusions, they were importantly and significantly different arguments. The one was essentially a conservative argument, and the other one was a radical argument. The conservative argument in the 1970s was articulated clearly by a whole series of government spokespersons who said that, given, when I talk of government, I mean National Party government, National Party spokespersons said, well, given the political tradition of Afrikanerdom, with its large debt to Calvinism, it would be inappropriate for the state to commit itself to any strong notion of human rights. This idea drew intellectual sustenance, at least to a certain extent, from President Paul Kruger's famous pronouncement many years ago that the testing power of the courts, that is the power of the courts to test legislation against the Bill of Rights, that was nothing more than a principle which had been invented by the devil. Some government spokespersons dressed up this argument slightly more eloquently. I think the most persuasive of the arguments was given by a later Minister of Justice, Kwabe Kutsia, who said that rights were simply too indeterminate, they couldn't be crystallized or formulated in the form of a Bill of Rights, and moreover, to have a Bill of Rights would politicize the role of judges to an uncontrollable extent. That was essentially the conservative argument against the Bill of Rights in the 1970s. The radical argument in exactly the same period departed, of course, from very, very different premises, but reached similar conclusion. The radical argument tended to draw on a strong tradition of Marxist thought, which had been opposed to a notion of human rights as being allegedly bourgeois obstacles on some historically predetermined path to communism. Many of the radicals drew on the Marxist pedigree for their opposition to a Bill of Rights, but they also drew on a more pragmatic argument, saying that to have a Bill of Rights in South Africa would simply act as a check on progressive change which was needed to correct the imbalances of the past. This radical argument was well articulated in 1986 when a number of students at what were then black universities formed a committee which was expressly called an anti-Bill of Rights committee. The express purpose of the committee was to oppose a Bill of Rights in any new constitutional dispensation. If I can be anecdotal for a moment, this committee was formed in 1986 at a conference at the University of Cape Town, which I helped organize as a student. The conference, in fact, had nothing to do with a Bill of Rights. It was a conference about the state of emergency which was operating in South Africa, but an extremely strong lobby saw the subtext at the conference as involving endorsement of a Bill of Rights, and consequently formed this anti-Bill of Rights committee, which said in their programmatic statement, they said, the introduction of a Bill of Rights would above all entrench the right of the white minority to 87% of South Africa's land surface and 95% of its productive capacity. A Bill of Rights would therefore not be conducive to a just solution which would ensure stability, progress, and sound human relations in South Africa. Now, there's a striking kind of reverse symmetry between these two arguments, the conservative argument on the one hand, a radical argument on the other, reaching a similar conclusion. The radical argument, of course, feared that a Bill of Rights would act as a check on sufficiently far-reaching change, while the conservative argument quite clearly was prompted by a fear that the Bill of Rights would introduce too much change. It would serve to topple the institutions of apartheid. These conservative and radical arguments were extremely strong in the 1970s and the early 1980s, but from the mid-1980s, a fairly remarkable thing happened. The two major power blocs in South African politics both took on board the notion of a Bill of Rights and came to endorse the notion that a new constitutional dispensation should in fact include a Bill of Rights after all. These two power blocs were the National Party government on the one hand, and the African National Congress on the other. I think it's worthwhile spending a little bit of time explaining how this convergence in attitude came about, since it does shed some important light on what we might expect from a Bill of Rights in a new constitution in South Africa. Beginning then with the National Party, I think it became clear in the mid-1980s that the shelf life of the apartheid state was near expiry, and the National Party at that stage began to forage around for alternative constitutional models. From the late 1980s, it became clear that the National Party had turned its back on its earlier arguments against the Bill of Rights, and in fact, it now took the view that a new constitution should include a Bill of Rights. The South African Law Commission published a well-publicized paper in 1988 saying that we should have a Bill of Rights in South Africa, and the National Party effectively endorsed this, so that when F.W. de Klerk made his famous speech at the opening of Parliament in February 1990, one of the planks was that he advocated a Bill of Rights in a new South African constitution. Now, this about turn by the National Party was such a miraculous one that I think we're entitled to say, perhaps with some cynicism, that it was a Road to Damascus experience of near miraculous proportions. And it's worth speculating very briefly about what might have prompted this Road to Damascus experience on the part of the National Party. In my view, it's very difficult to resist the inference that the sudden conversion by the National Party to the supposed virtues of a Bill of Rights really was a fairly cynical attempt by the party to fetter the powers of a future legislature, which would, for the first time in 45 years, not be dominated by the National Party. More to the point, the National Party's sudden disillusionment with the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, which they punted so forcibly in the 1970s, was really predicated on the realization that in a very few years, it would no longer be the National Party which would be pulling the strings in the exercise of that sovereignty. In my view then, I don't think commentators are being unduly cynical when they say that the National Party's endorsement of a Bill of Rights was an attempt to fence off certain aspects of white privilege. In a sense, it was endorsement of a kind of reactionary constitutionalism. The African National Congress has a long history, had a long history of commitment to a notion of human rights when it was in exile. I think no one could doubt the depth of the movement's commitment to human rights. But what hadn't been clear during the exile period was whether a commitment to human rights included a commitment to a notion of constitutional rights. Now that's an important distinction. The point is that advocates of human rights need in no sense be logically committed to a constitutionalizing of those rights coupled with an American-style practice of constitutional review. So while the National Party, I think, had a Road to Damascus experience, it seems to me that the ANC's endorsement of the Bill of Rights, also in the 1980s, didn't so much amount to a road to Damascus, but it did amount to a road less travelled. It was a decision by the ANC expressly to endorse a strong notion of rights which would be constitutionalised, coupled with a full-scale practice of judicial review. And this was the view taken by the Constitutional Committee of the ANC, which was formed in 1988 and formulated a number of draft bills of rights which were widely published in the late 1980s in South Africa. Now, it was by this, I think, fairly remarkable process that the two major power blocks in South Africa converged in the late 80s and threw their weight behind the need for a Bill of Rights in a new dispensation. Given this convergence of attitude, I think it was pretty much inevitable that the new constitution in South Africa would indeed include a Bill of Rights as one of its constituent elements. The process of negotiations started in 1990, but the crucial stage only happened in 1993. The negotiating process at that stage, there were a number of breakdowns beforehand, but that stage of the process was called by the negotiators the multi-party negotiating process. It was a group of 26 political parties which made decisions on the basis of sufficient consensus. The really important decision which were made related to legislation which was then enacted into law by the existing parliament. The centerpiece of the negotiations was agreement about a piece of legislation which was enacted as the so-called interim constitution, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa of 1993. Now, it's an interim constitution because it wasn't meant to last forever. It was meant to last simply for an interim bridging period while a fully democratic constitutional assembly could draw up a fully democratic form of a final constitution. That final constitution was agreed upon in 1996. It has now been certified by the South African Constitutional Court, and the final constitution will come into effect probably in the first half of this year. For our purposes, the important point is really this, that both the interim constitution and the final constitution include as one of their constituent elements a fully justiciable Bill of Rights. I want to spend a little bit of time speaking about each of these bills of rights, the interim Bill of Rights and the final Bill of Rights. The interim Bill of Rights was drafted by a committee which called itself a technical committee, consisted of five legal experts who acted in a non-representative capacity. They drafted the Bill of Rights largely on the basis of foreign experience, and the work was then tidied up by an ad hoc committee which consisted of political parties. I think it's important to draw attention to the fact that the interim Bill of Rights was expressly a product of political compromise, political give and take. I'm sure this may sound like a rather facile observation, but in fact it leads into a point of some substance, which I hope to address later on in this lecture. The reason to make this point is that certainly the natural rights tradition in jurisprudence sometimes leads us to believe that human rights have some sort of objective existence. They exist out there as part of the furniture of the universe, as ghostly apparitions which are seen to dance on the wall of some or other Platonic cave. Now, the South African Bill of Rights is imbued with no such mystical connotations. The rights which are contained in the Bill of Rights were not plucked from the writings on some supernatural cave wall. They were expressly the product of political compromise and horse trading during the negotiating process. Perhaps I can briefly mention one example just to bear out the point. A crucial issue during the negotiations was, should African customary law be given a so-called override, the ability to trump the equality clause in a Bill of Rights? In other words, should there be a period of time, or perhaps a permanent period of time, during which African customary law would not be susceptible to the right to equality which would be guaranteed in the Constitution? Now, this was a subject of extremely tricky negotiations. At a very late stage, the parties reached agreement that there would be a period of time during which customary law would be allowed to trump the equality clause. The clause was formulated after much hard bargaining. The African customary lobby then feared or thought that they had the negotiators on the run and tried to push their hand even further and demanded a permanent override for customary law. At that stage, the story from the negotiators is that they were so disgusted by the attitude on the part of the customary law lobby that they withdrew their support for any temporary override. In the result, the clause was drafted in such a way that there's no override for customary law in the interim constitution. The product which came down to us was expressly a product of political compromise between the negotiators. Now, so much for the interim Bill of Rights. The interim constitution demanded expressly that the final constitution had to contain a Bill of Rights. The final Bill of Rights was drafted by a series of committees. It was enacted into law last year. It very much follows the wording of the interim Bill of Rights, a couple of important differences, but to a large extent it shows the permanence of the temporary in politics. To a very large extent, it simply mimics the wording which had been decided upon during the negotiations regarding the interim constitution. Ladies and gentlemen, it's by that process that we've reached the stage which we now are at in South Africa. At the moment, the interim constitution is still in force. The interim Bill of Rights is the currently prevailing Bill of Rights. Probably in the first half of this year, it will be replaced by the wording of the final Bill of Rights, the charter contained in the final constitution. What I want to do now in the second half of this lecture is to tease out two puzzles which seem to me to be present within South Africa's transition to a Bill of Rights era. Both of these puzzles, I think, draw on the history which I've already sketched. It seems to me that they raise puzzling issues. The first puzzle has to do with the manner in which the Bill of Rights has been drafted, and the second puzzle has to do with the manner in which the Bill of Rights has to be interpreted. What I hope to do is to outline these two puzzles rather briefly, and then to suggest whether it might be possible to resolve the puzzles by bringing the two issues together. Let's start then with the first puzzle. The first puzzle builds on this. A Bill of Rights is usually understood to be a device for checking the political power of the majority in any society. To put the point another way, the primary purpose of a Bill of Rights is to remove certain issues from the ambit of parliamentary politics so that those choice insensitive issues will not be sacrificed at the whim of majoritarian preferences. Now, that's a view which I think will be recognizable most particularly from the writings of Ronald Dworkin. It's also a view of a Bill of Rights which has received the endorsement of the South African Constitutional Court in the judgment, one of the first judgments handed down regarding the death penalty. The president of the court stated, and the other members of the court agreed with him, the very reason for establishing the new legal order and for vesting the power of judicial review of all legislation in the courts was to protect the rights of minorities and others who cannot protect their rights adequately through the democratic process. Now, once we accept that that is the function of a Bill of Rights, once we accept that it functions in a counter-majoritarian way, then it seems to me to give rise to a puzzle which may be expressed as follows. Why should it be considered appropriate for the Bill of Rights to be drafted by the very political majority which is sought to be constrained thereby? To put the point another way, if we see the Bill of Rights as a kind of constitutional corset which restrains the state from responding to certain majoritarian impulses, why then should it fall to the majority to decide on the form which the corset is going to take? It seems to me that there's something intuitively plausible about the claim that it shouldn't fall to the majority to decide on what rights the minority are going to have. Now, these questions are particularly perplexing in the South African context because it will be recalled that the interim Bill of Rights was decided upon by a process of sufficient consensus in the multi-party negotiating process, and the final Bill of Rights was passed by a 2/3 majority of the Constitutional Assembly. try and make this puzzle slightly more concrete, let me refer to a number of clauses which were omitted from the final Bill of Rights. When the Constitutional Assembly drafted the final Bill of Rights, they in fact invited members of the public to make written submissions to them as regard the kind of rights which should be included in the Charter. It's recently been reported in the press that the following submissions were received by the Constitutional Assembly, but were not included in the final Bill of Rights. Let me give you a brief list of the rights which were omitted. A right to be free from prohibitive taxes, a clause to protect the aged, the right to own firearms, the protection of the rights of Rastafarians, the protection of animal rights, the right to play sport, a particularly South African right, and finally, the right to breastfeed, a right which I'm not awfully sure where it comes from, but it was one of the submissions received by the CA. Now, of course, some of those rights, I think, are slightly wacky ones, but some of them are certainly sustainable in principle. A good example might be the rights of Rastafarians to equal treatment. And that, I think, gives rise to the nub of the problem. If Rastafarians claim a right to equal treatment which should be included in the Bill of Rights, the problem is this: why should it fall to the very majority, which is going to be constrained by the Bill of Rights, to decide whether or not the rights of Rastafarians should be included in the Bill of Rights, the very document which is meant to act as a constraint on the majority? I want to describe this puzzle in slightly different language, and I want to do so by drawing on terminology which is, I think, probably more familiar in the language of personal ethics. If we ignore the impact of a Bill of Rights on existing legislation, then I think it's quite clear that the main effect, the main prospective effect of a Bill of Rights, is to disempower an existing or a future parliament from enacting certain laws, from reaching certain outcomes. Now, to the extent that the outcomes which are prohibited by the Bill of Rights are not outcomes which parliament would have wished to reach anyway, to that extent, Bill of Rights doesn't add much to what would have been reached under a doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. Where the Bill of Rights does some work, however, is in those situations where it restrains Parliament from reaching certain outcomes which Parliament would have wished to achieve had Parliament been suitably empowered. Let's call that, simply for shorthand, let's call that the constraint operating in the Bill of Rights. The crucial question then is, well, who gets to decide on the wording of the constraint in the Bill of Rights? And the South African answer is, it gets decided upon by a majority, or in some cases, a supermajority. Now, the first puzzle is really this. If the majority simply decided on the wording of the constraint on the basis of their first-order political preferences, then the constraint really wouldn't have any content, because the Bill of Rights would simply mimic the outcomes which would have been reached anyway under a doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. In other words, there's only going to be a constraint in the Bill of Rights if the majority which drafts the Bill of Rights adopts certain second order preferences about the type of first order preference which they would wish to act upon in the future. In other words, what the constraint requires is that the majority would have to say, it would be illegitimate for us to treat minorities in certain ways, even though, as a matter of first order preference, we would prefer to do so. To put the point in some philosophical jargon, the constraint would then operate as a kind of pre-commitment or democratic self-restraint. Perhaps to put the point in less jargonistic terms, if we adopt this particular interpretation, the Constitution would then amount to Peter drunk, while The Constitution would amount to an endorsement of second-order preferences, restraining the kind of first-order preferences which the majority might otherwise feel compelled to act upon. The essence of the first puzzle is, can we be confident that when it comes to drafting a Bill of Rights, the majority will, in fact, endorse second-order preferences in this way? The second puzzle isn't about the drafting of the Bill of Rights, it's about the interpretation of the Bill of Rights. And in particular, it's about the fact that both the final Bill of Rights and the interim Bill of Rights really seem to have a consequence that the text of the Constitution is to a certain extent displaced from the process of constitutional interpretation. I'm going to talk of the displacement of the text. It's probably correct that that exaggerates the position somewhat. Perhaps what I should really say is that the Bill of Rights extends the interpretive inquiry in two directions, and it extends the inquiry away from the actual wording of the text of the Bill of Rights. The first direction in which the inquiry has been extended is on the basis of a provision in the Constitution which says when a court comes to interpret the Bill of Rights, a court is required to promote the values which underlie an open and democratic society based on freedom and equality. Now, this amounts in effect to a kind of a displacement of the text, because if the court is able to, the interpreting court, is able to have regard to values, even where those values are not contained within the text, then, to a certain extent at least, the text of the Bill of Rights is displaced from the interpretive inquiry. And certainly this is the view which has been taken by the Constitutional Court, which has endorsed a purposive approach to interpretation, where the purposes are purposes which may well find no anchor within the text of the Constitution itself. A second direction in which the interpretive inquiry has been extended is on the basis of a provision in the Constitution which says that when a court comes to interpret a Bill of Rights, it must have regard to public international law and may have regard to foreign case law. Of course, there are two limbs there. The second limb is perhaps less important. It simply says a court may have regard to case law, and simply a permissive section. The court could have done that anyway. The more interesting point is the first limb, which says a court must have regard to public international law when it comes to interpreting the Bill of Rights. Now, that mandatory injunction, I think, makes sense in the case of treaties to which South Africa is a party. Makes sense that the Bill of Rights should be interpreted in the light of the country's treaty obligations. But the Constitutional Court has held that it doesn't stop there. The injunction requires the court also to have regard to international human rights instruments and treaties to which South Africa is not a party. A good example of this is the European Convention on Human Rights. That, of course, is a convention to which South Africa is not a party and will never be a party. But the court has held that, in terms of the constitutional injunction, it has to have regard also to the European Convention when it comes to interpreting the South African Bill of Rights. Now, there's a kind of a displacement of the text here, inasmuch as the court is empowered and indeed enjoined to look outside of the text when it comes to interpreting the provisions of both the interim and the final constitution. It seems to me then that those are two puzzles which strike me as raising perplexing issues about the South African transition to a Bill of Rights. I want to consider whether it would be possible to perhaps allay some of our puzzlement by seeing whether those two puzzles are related to one another in some ways. Remember that the first puzzle was about this: why should the majority decide on the right which the minority is going to have? Perhaps, though, it might be said, well, the answer to that first puzzle lies encapsulated in the second puzzle, because the whole point of the second puzzle is that when a court interprets the Bill of Rights, it's not tightly shackled to the wording of the Constitution. There's a certain amount of free play. Indeed, there's a certain extent to which the Constitution is displaced from the process of interpretation. I think that this answer does provide a solution to the first puzzle, at least in as much as we focus on the extent to which the Constitution is displaced in favor of international law. Really, what is happening by means of the displacement, the mandatory injunction that a court must have regard to international law when it comes to interpret the Bill of Rights. Really what is happening is that the drafters have sought to tap into an entrenched and fairly well-established body of law relating to the international protection of human rights. In other words, the effect of this displacement is that the jurisprudence of international human rights law, which there is a substantial and well-established body, is made applicable in the development of South Africa's burgeoning human rights law. What this means then is that I think we might see the first puzzle as being solved by taking the view that the displacement of the text in favor of international law really amounts to an attempt by the drafters to incorporate by reference the whole body of doctrine out there relating to international human rights law. The immediate point of relevance for us, of course, is that that body of international human rights law is insensitive to the preferences of the majority which drafted the wording of the Bill of Rights in South Africa. If I can use the language, the jargon which I introduced earlier, I can put the point this way. The displacement of the text in favor of international law then amounts to the embodiment of a second-order preference. It's a second-order preference by the majority that they should not act on their first-order preferences if this is going to produce results inconsistent with international standards relating to the protection of human rights. Just to rephrase that slightly, the deference by the drafters towards international human rights law then amounts in effect to a kind of democratic self-restraint, a form of pre-commitment which is, I think, sustainable and logical in principle. It seems to me then that we might indeed solve the first puzzle in this way. Unfortunately, however, it seems to me that the second puzzle is still left as raising extremely perplexing issues. The part of the second puzzle which remains unresolved is the displacement in the text in favor of a general resort to values. This, I think, is still a puzzle because once an interpreting court is able to have a kind of free-floating regard to values which are not contained in the text, then I think this raises extremely difficult issues about democratic credibility and about the democratic role of a constitutional court. It seems to me that the tension which is at stake here and the tension which I wish to explore was memorably captured by Justice Kentridge, who acted as a judge of the Constitutional Court before returning to the London Bar. In the very first judgment of the Constitutional Court, Justice Kentridge made the point as follows. He said, if the language used by the lawgiver is ignored in favor of a general resort to values, the result is not interpretation, but divination. The result is not interpretation, but divination. Now, I think there's a profound point locked up there, and perhaps we can restate the objection to divination as opposed to interpretation as follows. I think it's clear that in most cases, when a court comes to interpret a Bill of Rights, it's going to be making a moral judgment of some or other kind. However, the moral judgment which a court makes when it interprets a Bill of Rights, that should not be an all things considered moral judgment, because else it's going to become impossible to establish the democratic credentials of the practice of constitutional review. The reason for that is as follows. It's clear that in most cases, when Parliament passed the law, which is now subjected to constitutional review, when Parliament passed the law, the elected representatives would have made a moral decision about the kind of law which they wished to pass. It's difficult to explain why an unelected constitutional court should be able to second-guess that decision made by Parliament by reopening the moral decision in an all-things-considered way. In other words, the practice of constitutional review, I think, can only be saved from the charge of democratic illegitimacy if it's possible to distinguish the institutional position of the court, on the one hand, from the institutional position of Parliament on the other hand. And I think the best way to make that distinction is to say the constitutional rules must make a difference to the outcome which a court is going to reach when it decides on the constitutionality of a statute. In other words, the point I'm trying to make is, in order to counter the charge of democratic illegitimacy, we would have to say that the textual rules, the rules which are contained in the Constitution, have an impact upon the decision which the court would have reached had it been free to make an all things considered moral judgment. That is the reason, I think, why, in Justice Kentridge's terms, we require the court to engage in a process of interpretation, not a process of divination, having regard to all things considered moral criteria. Now, if that argument's correct, then I think it will be clear that the displacement of the text in favour of free-floating values, values which are not located within the constitutional rules, that, I think, really empowers the court to make an all things considered moral judgment in matters of interpretation. And this, I think, raises extremely difficult, in fact, intractable problems of democratic commitment. So, what I am suggesting is that the displacement of the text in favour of international law makes sense, but the displacement of the text in favour of these free-floating values seems to me raises intractable problems of democratic commitment. What I'd like to do in the time available is really the third aspect of my lecture. I'd like to touch on very briefly, since I am pressed for time, I'd like to touch on some aspects of what the Constitutional Court has done in the 2 years of its existence. I should say that the Constitutional Court was a newly established court. It was set up from scratch with a brief to make only constitutional decisions. It's been sitting for just under 2 years now. It's handed down 41 judgments to date, a number of extremely profound judgments about, in some cases, technical matters, in some cases, far-reaching matters of public importance. I don't think it's appropriate for me to give a detailed blow-by-blow account of what the South African Constitutional Court has done. But what I would like to do is to tease out one or two of the aspects of constitutional interpretation, which I think will be of interest to a foreign audience, since I think they raise issues not just about South Africa, but far-reaching issues about legality and underlying notions of what a legal system involves. I think the clue in this regard is to focus on the one word which runs almost like a mantra, really, all the way through the Constitutional Court's jurisprudence. Time and time again, the court has told us that what they have to do is make a value judgment. Now, they've repeated this so often that it can become quite irritating after a while. They tell us that constitutional interpretation involves the making of a value judgment. It's a holistic inquiry in which they must have regard to the values of a democratic South Africa. The point, I think, was perhaps most clearly made by Justice Sachs, who wrote in one of the first judgments of the court, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is a momentous document, intensely value-laden. To treat it with the dispassionate attention one might give to a tax law would be to violate its spirit, as set out in plain language. Now, one might think that that dictum is perhaps a bit unfair on tax lawyers, but certainly it makes the point, which the court has been at pains to stress, that when they interpret the Bill of Rights, they're doing something very different to what they're doing when they engage in the interpretation of other statutes, or perhaps in the making of the common law. One might be tempted to dismiss this as simply verbiage or rhetorical bluster, but I think this preoccupation with the role of values does in fact provide us with a fairly important clue and insight as to what has happened in the South African legal order. And in order to tease out what has happened at a deep level, I want to draw on some terminology which has been employed in a fascinating recent, fairly recent, comparative study of the English legal system and the American legal system by Patrick Attia and Robert Summers. The distinction emerges quite clearly in the title of their book, which is Form and Substance in Anglo-American Law. The disjunction, or the juxtaposition, is between form on the one hand and substance on the other. The distinction is really this. Attia and Summers distinguish between a formal reason for a decision and a substantive reason for a decision. Now, a substantive reason to make a decision one way or another way would be a moral, economic, political, or any other kind of social consideration. The classic two types of substantive reasons would, of course, be goal reasons on the one hand and right reasons on the other. A formal reason, on the other hand, is a legally authoritative reason on which judges or other decision makers are required to base their decision. It's a reason which overrides any countervailing substantive reason which has not been incorporated into the formal reason. To make the point in slightly easier language, the existence of a legal rule is a formal reason for making a decision one way. The rule acts as a kind of a screen. It insulates the decision maker from going behind the screen and having regard to any substantive reason which has not been incorporated into the legal rule. To put the point another way, legal rules and formal reasons, they get in the way. They impede the decision maker from having regard to the kind of substantive reasons which he or she might otherwise have considered appropriate. Now, I think that distinction, albeit not the language, will be familiar to most lawyers. Attia and Summers then, in fact, extrapolate and set up two competing visions of law. These are no doubt ideal types, but it's quite a useful juxtaposition, I think. A formal vision of law on the one hand, and a substantive vision of law on the other. A formal vision of law is simply one which identifies most standards for the identification of valid law as being source-oriented, so that the substantive content of the law is thought to be pretty much irrelevant to the questions of legal validity. In terms of this vision, we think of the form of law as being determinate, hard and fast rules. They have hard edges, and they screen off consideration of the kind of policy reasons which might otherwise be considered relevant to the making of a decision. The substantive vision of law, on the other hand, is one which invites law to be subjected to content-oriented standards of validity, such that if a legal rule is going to be valid, it's going to have to comply, at least in part, with certain standards about what is just, or what is good, or what is morally right. In other words, the substantive vision is really one which invites a major infusion of substantive reasoning into the process of legal reasoning. Now, I think it's useful to keep those two visions of law in mind. Attia and Summers really set up those two competing visions to make the point that the English legal system is much more committed to the formal vision of law than is the American legal system, which more expressly endorses a substantive vision of law. The point I want to make, and I can't argue for it tonight, but having studied both in South Africa and in England, there's no doubt to my mind that historically the South African legal system has been even more committed to the formal vision of law than has the English legal system. In other words, if you see a gradation from American legal system to English legal system on this substantive formal spectrum, there's no doubt that historically the South African legal system has been much more committed to the formal vision even than the English legal system. Certainly, that has been the case for the greater part of 1.5 centuries of legal development in South Africa. And against that background, it seems to me that the crucial thing which the Bill of Rights does is it really acts as a locus of open-ended substantive values, which can only be interpreted by courts if they are prepared to engage in a process of substantive reasoning. In other words, it's impossible to interpret the Bill of Rights in a formalistic way. It's impossible to make any sense of its open-ended standards unless one is prepared to engage expressly with a process of substantive reasoning. Let me give you an example. The structure of the Bill of Rights in South Africa is such that a number of rights are given. All of the rights can then be limited as long as the limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society committed to liberty and equality. I think it's pretty clear that there's no way to make any sense of that limitations clause other than engaging in a process of substantive reasoning, which is going to require, amongst other things, the development of some sort of moral theory about what is required in an open and democratic society committed both to liberty and equality. In summary then, I think what the Bill of Rights does is, in South Africa, at a deep level, it really invites not just judges, but academics, practitioners, anybody with an interest in law, to have a kind of a paradigm shift in the sort of vision which they see as informing the law. A shift, in other words, from a formal vision to a substantive vision. It seems to me that in the 2 years of its existence, the one way to assess what the Constitutional Court has done is to ask how successful has it been in embracing the substantive vision. Now, I think it's important not to be ungenerous or flip about this. Any transition of such a fundamental nature is going to be traumatic for anybody, and I think we can see the signs of the trauma pretty clearly in what the Constitutional Court has been doing in the 2 years of its existence. In the written paper which Professor Collins referred to earlier, what I try to do is to set out 9 different headings of ways in which the Constitutional Court has been successful in embracing the substantive vision of law. Due to lack of time, I'm not going to mention any of those, but I think it's clear, as Professor Collins said, that the record has been pretty well a mixed one. In some cases, the court has shown a reluctance, I think, fully to endorse what has been happening at a deep level in the South African legal order. In some cases, at least, it still clings to a formal vision of law, and that creates, in my view, extremely difficult problems about understanding exactly what the Constitutional Court is purporting to be doing when it makes these far-reaching decisions. Perhaps the most far-reaching one was a decision which struck down the death penalty in South Africa. Inevitably, that must raise issues of political morality, yet the court insisted it was not making any kind of moral decision, it was simply making a legal decision. That kind of decision seems to me to show a reluctance fully to endorse the substantive vision of law which now underpins the South African legal order. It's time to try and draw together some threads from the preceding discussion. I think it's true to say that at various parts in this lecture, I've demonstrated a certain ambivalence about what the Bill of Rights means for the South African legal order. Certainly, I haven't tried to be evangelistic about a whole-scale triumph on our part. And it seems to me that in some ways, then, the Bill of Rights in South Africa resembles Wittgenstein's famous image of the duck rabbit, which explains the title of tonight's lecture. It's an image, it's a line drawing, which can be seen either as a duck's head or as a rabbit's head, simply depending on the perspective we adopt. It's one of those images which simply shifts under our gaze. Almost within seconds, it can look like a duck, and then the next second like a rabbit. It seems to me that in a similar way, if we look at the Bill of Rights in South Africa, like the image of the duck rabbit, the Bill of Rights seems to shift and dance under our gaze, depending really on the perspective we adopt. If we adopt one perspective, it seems to me that we might see the Bill of Rights as a deeply flawed product, really a product of political expediency. A document, to a large extent, damned by its genesis to attract our derision. I think the miraculous road to Damascus conversion of the National Party would have triggered our cynicism, the process by which the Interim Bill of Rights was drafted amidst political horse trading at the World Trade Center would probably have confirmed some doubts, and the backward-looking bias of the final product may well have certified our distrust. If we perceive it in this way, the Bill of Rights, certainly the Interim Bill of Rights, would simply be too much tied up with the past to fulfill any useful function in a transition to the new. Almost with a blink, however, the image can reform before our eyes as an ennobling document, as an empowering document, as a document which affirms those very human rights which many activists fought for and in some cases died for over many decades in this century. If we see the document this way, what we perceive is a document which was produced in terms of a constitutional revolution in which the old order slid seamlessly into the new with no break whatsoever in continuity. Perceived in this way, then, we might say that the Interim Bill of Rights replaced what had hitherto been a discourse of oppressive power with a discourse of rights, affirming the claims of all South Africans to be treated with equal concern and respect. Now, for me, these two images tend to flit rather teasingly in and out of perspective. And though it seems to me that both of them are latent, I want to suggest that ultimately it's the second image, it's the positive image, which amounts to the better representation of the South African reality. The most powerful reason to endorse this second image, the positive image, I think, is just to consider what the Bill of Rights means at a deep level for a notion of legality in South Africa. We really come full circle here. I began this lecture by drawing attention to law during apartheid, which was an era of repressive law, the integration of law and politics. What the Bill of Rights does, I think, is to enunciate a decisive break with that old repressive order. It inserts, symbolically, if you like, a kind of a notional wedge between law and politics, and makes it extremely difficult to envisage that an era of repressive law could ever occur again in South Africa. Ultimately, then, I think it seems to me that repressive law during the years of apartheid clearly fell within the former category. What the South African Bill of Rights has done is to redraw the lines which delineate the image of law in South Africa so as to remove what had hitherto been a crudely one-dimensional aspect. I think it's true to say that the historical evolution of the Bill of Rights will always provoke some cynicism on the part of jaded onlookers, certainly jaded South African onlookers. But at the end of the day, what we've been left with is a product that confers on all South Africans the status of empowered rights bearers and entitled claimants. Considered purely in terms of the forms of legality, it seems to me that this amounts to nothing less than a juridical emancipation, and for that reason alone, it is to be welcomed. Thank you very much.
Just remains for me to thank Alfred Cockerell for a most eloquent and comprehensive talk about the South African Bill of Rights. He's covered a lot of ground in the past time, the history of it, the content, how it's been interpreted, and views about the future, which I found most fascinating. The only puzzle I'm left with is whether the positive image is the duck or the rabbit. I must say, whenever I've looked at that image, the ducks always looked a bit more like a penguin, which is probably more suitable for South Africa. Since when I went to South Africa, it was, of course, to go and see the penguins down on Cape Town. I'm pleased so many of you could come. We are now pleased to invite you all to a reception afterwards on the fifth floor of this building in the senior dining room, where you can meet Professor Cockerell and meet other guests and have a drink with us. So I hope we can see you all upstairs. Just remains for me to thank you once again for a most impressive lecture. Thank you very much.